Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, April 14, 2005. This is a joint committee on Ways and Means, subcommittee on Human Services. Today we have a public hearing on House Bill 5058, which relates to the budget for the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We'll begin with some remarks by Deborah Manthe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As the Chair said, the Psychiatric Security Review Board is back for their Phase 2 portion of their budget presentation, which is the detail. Before we kick it over to Ms. Dean, though, I wanted to let you know that at your places, the agency has brought in responses to Senator Mona Sanderson's questions. It's a memo from Mike Morris, with the Mental Health Policy Manager of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, who's in the audience. And on the 5th, I believe, or 4th of April, the agency also provided responses to Representative Hanna's question about reconciling the case numbers, the number of new cases, the total number of active cases. And I just thought that maybe the agency might want to, if you had questions, go over that before we started the presentation.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go ahead and begin. You can decide how you want
to. I'll go ahead and start then. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Dean. I'm with DAS Budget and Management Division. You should have in front of you a presentation that you're probably getting familiar with the looks of. On page 2, the charts show the human services program area by total funds on the left and general funds, lottery funds on the right. This budget is 0.03% when looking at the general fund lottery funds budget. The agency's primary linkage is to the governor's principle that Oregonians have a right to be safe. This linkage is driven by the fact that the agency's core mission is to manage the care of criminal offenders with mental health needs. It's also aligned with the human services principle. On page 4, the chart shows the agency's fund split. The other funds that you see, that little sliver, is the unspent balance of a one-time $10,000 award the board received from the American Psychiatric Association for its innovative program. And these funds provide training opportunities for the board members and the staff. On page 5, you can see the budget categories. Personal services are 77% of this agency's budget, and services and supplies are 23%. Turning to page 6, you can see the historical snapshot of the board's budget, and you can see a significant increase this year in the general fund. That increase is due to the addition of one staff member to address workload issues that have been building for the past 10 years. In addition, the board's spending pattern for the first year of the 2003-05 biennium was analyzed, and based on the experience, the services and supplies budget was reduced by 10%, which we believe will be sustainable. Turning to page 7, the primary issue that faces the board is the rising caseload growth. There are more than 700 people currently under the board's jurisdiction, and the current shortage of mental health services in the community increases the number of people who need psychological treatment but who do not receive those services. Those individuals then are commonly brought into contact with law enforcement agencies. The board has identified a number of clients at the state hospital who could be moved into community placements if adequate supports were available, but these supports have decreased over the past several years as a result of budget reductions. This inability to discharge patients has overcrowded the forensics wards at Oregon State Hospital, which DHS is currently reviewing. And if that review results in transferring services to the community, the workload on the board will increase because it will need to manage an even higher number of community placements. And then finally, on the last page, there is a policy package in the governor's budget that adds one position and the related SMS to help manage caseload growth. It has risen about 53% in the last decade, and the agency has done a lot to manage the workload increase by creating efficiencies with technology improvements, updating its and consolidating its data systems, et cetera. But at this time, we believe a position is necessary to handle the workload. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
I just want to ask Marie Claire.
Certainly. Senator Carter.
When we look at the increase in costs, are these in PSRB, is it because of the older people with long-term care needs, or is it because of the condition of those that do come in who are Medicaid eligible?
Chair Richardson, Senator Carter, the cost to the board, you mean, or?
Right. You said on page 7, caseload growth is expected to continue.
Yeah. Chair Richardson, Senator Carter, our projections are that the number of individuals coming under the board will continue to increase. We've seen in the packet that I provided earlier, the blue folder, there are a number of charts which will show the increase in the number of clients we get per year. We used to have basically, average 55, 60 new clients, and in the late 90s that went up into the 70s. In 2003, we hit 110, and this past year we hit 126 new clients for the year. So that's what's causing the increase in our numbers.
Sure.
Follow-up, please.
Oh, follow-up.
But then maybe my assumption is wrong. Are all of these people in the PSRB under your direction, are they all Medicaid eligible?
Chair Richardson, Senator Carter, no.
Okay.
They are not.
So of those that are Medicaid eligible, what's the percentage of those that are coming in every year? Because I see where my concern in this state is that we look at growth across all lines, but the information I have is that growth is faster, greater in the long-term care area. And I'm trying to find out if you see that that's true, too, and how do you and Mr. Taves cross-section your work with long-term care issues?
Chair Richardson, Senator Carter, I don't have those figures. Actually, those would be with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I don't have the exact, because the way our system is set up, they actually pay for the care and treatment of our clients, and the board's budget only covers the, staff and the hearings process.
Okay, so this long-term care piece in your thing has been taken care of through DHS?
Yes.
Okay. Because, Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if this were segmented in such a way that these data here is not connected with the data with the long-term care in DHS, but that's been clarified for me. So the projections are one and the same in the DHS budget about the growth of long-term care.
I had the same question that when Jandine mentioned that there is a reduction in community mental health facilities, but I wasn't clear if you were talking about state-operated community health facilities or secured community-operated or private secured facilities.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was referring to the, I'm trying to think how to say, when they are released from the state hospital but still under board supervision, they go into these community centers that are, I believe, sometimes private, but they are then contract with the state. So they are approved facilities that provide the oversight that these people need when they are released to the community.
Okay, so it could be both, actually.
Yes.
Senator Bates?
Well, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, this is kind of a question we asked before, but a certain amount of this is for my own review. You're dealing with two basic client bases, one, or an increase in client base, I think because of two reasons, and I want to get a clear picture of this. One is that probably because we don't have as good a mental health program out in the community now, we have people who are persistently and chronically mentally ill committing crime, and they clearly come into your system, and that's probably an increase from that. I'm also concerned that you're seeing more people who might not fall in that first category, but have some borderline difficulties, and that's a pretty vague phrase I'm going to use, who because of ballot measure 11 are going to opt for a plea of guilty except for a reason of insanity. Both those I would expect will drive up your caseload. I would guess that those people are not going to be Medicaid eligible, because one, they committed a crime, and two, they're going to be non-categorical people. And some of them might be Medicare eligible because of their chronically and persistent mental illness. What is the overall thought on as far as we're going to deal with this new population? I expect that as this continues, we're going to see more and more people come in and continue acceleration. Do you have any idea what this population will look like in a year, 2 or 3 years as far as size? And what those people actually, what are the diagnoses they're coming in with? Are we looking at schizophrenics committing crime? I mean, give me a picture of these people, if you can.
Jim Richardson, Senator Bates, the majority of our clients do suffer from schizophrenia. That's the primary diagnosis, followed by bipolar schizoaffective. The majority are also dually diagnosed in terms of having a substance abuse problem as well. In the charts that are provided in the blue folder, you'll see that in the red tab, under the total clients we're projecting right now, given the numbers, we already have 33 new clients this year, and it's only April 14th, that if we continue on this current path, a conservative estimate of even 100 or 120 new clients will bring us by the next biennium to a total clientele of over 930 clients. Currently, this morning, we have 728. We are seeing individuals, to give you a brief snapshot, the 96% of our clients are under the board for felonies. Of those, 48% are for Class A felonies, which are 20 years or longer. 10% are for unclassified, which are mostly murders. 10 years or 19% on Class C felonies are only 23%. So we only get 4% misdemeanors. So these are persons who have committed serious crimes. The majority are male, as you would imagine. A median age is about 42 right now. As I said, there's 307 living in the community right now. The rest are at the state hospital. And of those living in the community, we have 8% in secure residentials, 16% in other group home type settings, and 27% in foster homes, and the rest living independently or semi-independently. So we have a range of living situations for these individuals once they're ready to be released to the community. And I see that given the crisis at the state hospital, that number of individuals living in the community will increase in the next biennium as well, because the push now is to develop more community placements so that to relieve the overcrowding and to move those individuals who could be adequately controlled or treated, don't need that level of psychiatric care, of hospital level care, to community-based placements.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Two problems here. Some of these may be eligible for Medicaid match once they leave the state hospital, which is a big factor for us due to cost. The reaction in my community, which is fairly liberal, mm-hmm. is a certain amount of not my backyard and a certain amount of fear of how well those local communities can deal with potentially dangerous individuals. There's been reassurances that's not a problem, but I hear stories in both directions, and this is clearly where your responsibility is key, mm-hmm. making sure that we do move these people out, but that do not become a danger to themselves or others, especially when you just told me that these people have committed major felonies, including, I understand, murder.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Chair Richards, Senator Bates, that is the biggest, barrier that we have right now. There, as you well know, has been a concerted effort this biennium to develop more community placements. And, in fact, I've been to your community and was privileged to be at a community meeting, which are not always the most pleasant activities to participate in, but you're right, and that is why, frankly, we're asking for this position, because I think the more individuals we place in the community, the more important it is to be able to monitor them very closely so that we can assure, as we ask the communities more and more to accept these people back into their communities, to assure them that, in fact, they will be monitored and that the public safety will be secured. And, you know, I think that our, you know, statistics continue to show that. You know, as I told you last time, the our current recidivism rate for this biennium is only 1%, and it's only 2% since we started keeping measures in 1992. But you're right, you know, just telling community members that is not always, you know, the easiest thing. You have to basically prove it to them. And over the period of time, I think, particularly the facility that we've recently located in your community has not had any difficulties, you know, and I always knock on wood because given this population, there are no guarantees, and I can't make any, but we do the best we can to mitigate any risk to the citizens of all communities.
Thank you. You know, just to kind of follow up on what you're saying, one of the reasons that we have this huge increase, and I may not have the facts exactly right, but it seems that it's OYA that now that there's a directive that if they have a juvenile that is in their custody for 7 days and they are believed to have a mental condition, they must be out of their facility and transferred into a proper care. Is that correct? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Chair Richardson, we don't at this point have juveniles, so I'm not familiar with the OYA situation.
I know that they have to be transferred, so it's putting pressure on wherever, maybe it's a state hospital.
Yeah. Chair Richardson, you may be referring to the aid and assist, and that's correct. If an individual at the trial level is found unable to aid and assist their lawyer, the federal courts have mandated that those individuals must be admitted to the state hospital within 7 days of that court finding. And so that has contributed. The hospital's census crisis is not just about the PSRB clientele, but about these people who have been sent there to be treated until they were fit to face trial, and there has been a great increase in those numbers as well.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair?
If it's on that, go ahead.
Yes, on that particular issue, because I've been reading in the paper regarding the hospitals now suing DHS because they can't meet that timeline. They will put them in the local hospitals until a bed opens up, or there may be other reasons why they put them in the hospital. Is that part of the problem? I mean, is it a problem because we don't have the beds, or is it a problem because Medicaid will pay for them in the hospital? And I mean, this is a complex issue.
It is. It may be going beyond
what we
have. Senator Mona Sanderson, part of that, the suit, I think, relates to the civil committed clients or people who are waiting for that. I think the state hospital, you know, has to accept the ones that are in the criminal system. But the civil people, they've been trying to divert into community local hospitals, and I think that's the payment for those local hospitals is the issue for
the friends are just hanging out. There's no room anymore.
Right. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This kind of relates to the census type questions. You said you only had 4% of your clients are misdemeanors. In Multnomah County, we have a great many mentally ill people that move in and out of the criminal justice system. How does the screening occur in terms of how do clients or people come under the auspices of your board compared to the people that are just kind of going through the revolving door system locally?
Sure. Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, in order to come under the board, you have to assert the insanity defense successfully, and that is an affirmative defense in Oregon, and so only the client in consultation with their lawyer can do that. No judge can force it on, nor a DA. Mm-hmm. With misdemeanors, secondly, our statute says that it's any felony or misdemeanor involving injury or risk of physical injury. So some of your nuisance misdemeanors that you may be referring to that you see in Multnomah County or the streets of Portland, if they don't involve that, they're not, the statute is designed not to, and they should, the idea was that they would be handled in the civil system. They could be, you know, a civil commitment could be initiated if that was appropriate, or if they asserted the defense and successfully, they could even be discharged by the judge. And, you know, having been a public defender in my previous life. There's also that issue of, you know, when you're talking to a client about whether to assert, in most cases, asserting the defense and coming under the board is more onerous than what the consequences for a misdemeanant would normally face. You know, a lot of times they get bench probation. They would get credit for time served if they were held in custody. And so from that perspective, whereas if they were put under our jurisdiction, they could, you know, be under our jurisdiction for a year. They may go to the hospital and stay there a lot longer than they would have been in a jail situation. And so many times I think that it's not proposed as an option for a misdemeanant client because of the consequences.
Thank you. Before I go to Senator Carter, just to follow up on kind of extension of Representative Hansen's comment, as a former defense attorney, my thought is that there would probably be certain people who would, because of Measure 11, might plead not guilty by reason of insanity and their basis is solely drug and alcohol, that they were incompetent at the time they committed the crime because they were so drunk or so loaded. And one, how would you feel about an amendment to the statute which says to which that, you know, to what kinds of conditions that defense would apply, and have alcohol and drug without a secondary mental diagnosis be excluded from the right to use insanity, temporary insanity as a plea?
Chair Richardson, we have struggled with this for a long period of time, because right now the Oregon law indicates that voluntary intoxication is not a defense. So people who use alcohol or drugs and commit crimes as a result shouldn't be allowed. The problem is, you know, for the board, is that most of these individuals don't initially come under the board for a substance abuse diagnosis or a, you know, substance abuse or drug abuse, or, you know, what they come. Some of these individuals evidently have a predisposition to psychosis if they were to use some kind of controlled substance or alcohol. And so they come under the board for things such as psychosis, psychotic disorder, NOS, brief reactive psychosis. So it looks like that at the time of the crime, I mean, and clearly I don't think there's any question, at the time of the crime they were psychotic and exhibited the same kinds of behaviors and thought processes that, you know, individuals with even schizophrenia or other mental illnesses may exhibit. But what happens is once they get to the hospital and they're not able to get those substances, their mental status clears, and then, the psychiatrists often determine that there isn't an underlying major mental illness. They are left with those substance abuse diagnoses, and then we're left to determine, and as I told you last time, the court had. We're waiting for the Supreme Court decision because we had two opposite decisions from the Court of Appeals regarding whether substance abuse was, in fact, a sufficient diagnosis for board jurisdiction. The only problem I have, and we've struggled with this, we actually submitted a legislative concept a number of years ago on this very issue to try and clear it up. The problem we have is that, you know, so many clients are duly diagnosed, and sometimes it takes a long period of time to determine whether, in fact, it is, you know, they are suffering from an underlying mental illness, and the substance use at the time of the crime or prior to the crime exacerbated that, or whether they really don't have any major mental illness and the psychosis was the result of solely of the use of the substances. So it's a little, you know, harder to break this apart. But we are...
Yeah, what you're saying is it's a battle of the experts.
Yeah.
You know, the guy acted crazy, so he must have been crazy, but he was drunk, and he has no prior treatment, no prior diagnosis, but now we're going to say temporary psychosis because of what he did. He had to be crazy, or he wouldn't have killed the guy.
And I think
the battle of the experts.
Sure. And Chair Richardson, I think also it's partly because, you know, in the cases here in Oregon, unlike other states, which obviously we can't afford at this point, but other states have longer periods of evaluation before you can assert the defense. And whereas in Oregon, you know, if somebody wants to assert that defense, I as a lawyer would, you know, hire a psychiatrist, a psychologist. You know, some of these evaluations could be an hour long, 4 hours long, 8 hours long, but they're certainly not anywhere near the length of time that the hospital has to observe them on a 24/7 basis without those substances. So, you know, they do it just in the snapshot, whereas once they get to the hospital and you have a longer period of time to observe them without, you know, the use of those substances, I think you get a clearer picture of what the individual actually is suffering from.
Just one final one then. In line with this conversation, with your experience and with the caseload that you see and the trends, mm-hmm. would it be your recommendation that there be legislative clarification that would indicate that use of alcohol or drugs would not be sufficient to justify a defense by reason of temporary insanity without a secondary diagnosis based on activities prior to the incident?
Chair Richardson, I think the board would support, you know, legislation that would exclude solely alcohol or drug diagnoses from the use of the defense. Yes.
Thank you. Senator Carter.
My question is in line with that, because my understanding is that a lot of the meth users are displaying high levels of psychotic behavior, and what I was wondering is what is the board doing to, in anticipation of a lot of these people might possibly be coming your way, and how do we gear the system up, because it's unbelievably high, the number of meth cases that we have in the state and the psychotic behavior that they're displaying.
Chair Richardson, Senator Carter, we are also seeing an increase in that population with individuals who, as I said, become psychotic as a result of their use of methamphetamine. And as you can well imagine, that drug in particular can make people very psychotic. And so,
yeah, they were saying that the meth is just has been tremendous in that among the 17 to 21-year-old group, they've seen violence and extreme psychotic behavior and some of it, because some of them have got such bad had such bad incidences with some of that meth, how it'd been cooked, and so they do display over a longer period of time psychotic behavior.
It's almost like the crime has two phases.
Yes.
The first is the decision to take the drug,
right.
And then the consequences of it.
Absolutely.
Like a person who gets drunk and then goes out and gets in a car crash, they're held responsible for the actions that they took that led to becoming intoxicated, you know, civil aspect.
Because I think it was up in some little part of Washington about a week or two ago that somebody was killed, and they were talking about how this person had been on methamphetamine, and it's just out of hand.
There's probably a couple complicating things involved that we don't know about, too, in this. One thing we do know is schizophrenics and people who have severe bipolar are very cyclic. They can be irrational for weeks at a time and then lose that, whether on medications or not sometimes. So you've got that issue to deal with. Secondly, we don't know yet the long-term effects of long-term heavy uses of methamphetamine or methamphetamine that's been made, I'll say, improperly. I don't know, there's no proper way to make it. Whether we are going to produce people who will be permanently psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
They may not recover from this. They'll certainly have diminished cognitive abilities. They'll be less rational in the future after they've been on this drug for a long time. And how severe that is, we don't know. And so, from my point of view, I'm very concerned about the decisions you have to make. You're going to have a snapshot of that person for a very short period of time. They're going to make decisions about putting them up in the public area or keeping them at a lockdown facility.
Mm-hmm.
The responsibility is going to be huge. And what I'm a little concerned about is that sooner or later, knocking on wood's not going to work.
Right.
And we can't keep them at the hospital, not only from the point of view of the conditions there, but also the cost. And you know, putting them up in the community has been done extremely carefully in such a way that people who drop out of the psychic situation and become psychotic again or dangerous again, we know immediately that's happened, so we can control those people before they hurt themselves or others. And I'm not criticizing you. You've got a terrible job to do, but I'm a little concerned that as we expand this program out in our communities, we kind of took the people out of the hospital the easiest first,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to start dipping into a population that's going to be a lot more difficult to predict. And if you predict wrong, you have to have something in that outpatient facility or the the home you place them in and immediately identifies them when they're having trouble and have some recourse for that person. I'm hoping you're there doing that. When I talked to my local law enforcement people in Ashland on the first issue, they were very concerned that was not in place. I think now the new place in Medford is there. But I just want to give you a word of caution again that I'm very concerned about that, and I'm sure you are too.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that you're also seeing an increase in the cases from meth. Out of the 126 cases in 2004, can you substantiate what that might be in terms of which that are related to the meth out of the increase?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I couldn't off the top of my head tell you, you know, how many were solely meth-induced psychoses, but I could get that information for you. Like I said, a majority of our clients, you know, are duly diagnosed and substance abuse is, you know, an issue as well, so they may well be have other diagnoses as well, but we definitely have seen, just as in the diagnosis we've received of new cases.
Okay. Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably irrelevant to the budget, but it kind of tracks with this conversation, though. Have you had cases that you're aware of that involved conditions that were provoked by steroid use?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanson, I'm not aware of any at this point.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and continue? Okay. We've gone far enough afield. Let's go back to your presentation. And,
okay. Chair Richardson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I am the executive director of the Psychiatric Review Board, which, as you know, is the agency that assumes jurisdiction over all persons found guilty except for insanity of a crime here in Oregon who may pose a substantial danger to others. The two primary factors that we've been talking about this morning already that are driving this budget request are the total number of clients under the board's jurisdiction and the number of clients on conditional release in the community, which obviously is a subset of that total number. As to the first, when I appeared at our budget presentation 2 years ago, our clientele numbered 600. Today, that number has grown to 728, which is more than a 20% increase. Again, in 2004, the board received more new clients in a year than it ever had. Further, the data suggests that this rate of growth will continue in the next biennium, as the number of new clients far exceeds the numbers who will be discharged from the board in that same period of time. The consequence of this on the board's operations has become overwhelming. The number of clients the board has to serve controls all that the board does, and it impacts both aspects of its program. First and foremost, it affects the number of hearings that must be held because each client is entitled to a hearing within time frames set out by the statute. Each new client must have a hearing within 90 days. Then the law allows them to request a hearing every 6 months, and the board then has 60 days within which to hold that hearing. Thus, every individual under the board could theoretically have three hearings per biennium. Fortunately for us at this point, that's not the case, but obviously, the possibility is there. That, in turn, drives the number of hearing days that must be scheduled and the number of stipends that must be funded for the board members' attendance. Further, every hearing requires a tremendous amount of work up front by each of my staff members in their various roles. Notices must be sent, a case summary must be written, exhibit file must be prepared, and so on. Secondly, the number of clients on conditional release drives the board's monitoring function, and this is a large concern, Senator Bates, as you noted, for the board and from the staff. Simply put, more people under the board living in the community means more people that the staff must supervise. With 306 individuals currently living in communities throughout the state today, which is an increase of 47 since last session, once again, there are more clients on conditional release than ever before, and we're not done with this biennium. You should be aware that the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services is projecting another 50 or 60 community placements by June 30th, just 2.5 months from now. Even if this is somewhat optimistic, having been intimately involved with this development process, I am confident that a significant percentage of those will be online by the end of June. Then, given the ongoing census crisis at the state hospital, the plan is to continue this new development process through the next biennium with the hope of creating another 94 more conditional release placements for PSRB clients in the 2005-07 biennium. If that comes to fruition, by the next time I appear here, we could have close to 500 individuals living in the community. Each of these individuals requires a tremendous amount of work by board staff to get to the point of release and significant time and energy thereafter as we closely monitor and supervise their progress in the community. The reason for this tremendous growth in clientele is not easily discernible or readily known, given, as I said, the insanity defense, you know, depends on a number of factors that occur between, you know, a defense attorney and the defendant. However, I think there are a number of environmental factors that contribute to this situation. As was mentioned, the demand, when the demand for mental health services increase, but those necessary community services are reduced or eliminated due to budget reduction, as has occurred in the recent past, persons who are unsuccessful in managing their mental illness are unable to obtain needed help, come to the attention of law enforcement officials. Other factors contribute to that situation as well, including the ongoing alcohol and drug epidemic that we referred to, the serious lack of available low-income, safe, alcohol and drug-free housing, which greatly enhances the likelihood of police contact for those chronically ill living on the streets, and the fear and stigma attached to serving such at-risk individuals, which impedes early intervention and treatment. Thus, the number of persons with mental health difficulties who are incarcerated in state and local facilities have risen dramatically in the last few years. Once charged with a crime, historically a small percentage of defendants opt for the insanity defense and usually by stipulation are placed under the PSRB. However, for the board, this small percentage has grown significantly in the last 5 years. The board is currently experiencing the continuation of the markedly upward trend in these numbers that began 3 biennia ago. The board used to average 55 new cases, as I mentioned. And then in 1999, the number jumped to 75. We stayed there for a couple of years, and then in 2003, as I mentioned, the number vaulted to 110. Last year, 126. And as I said, we already have 33 for this year, and it's only April 14th. Our hope at the time was that such a spike in number was an aberration. However, that doesn't appear to be the situation. This can obviously be attributed in part to the tremendous increase in the overall rate of incarceration of the mentally ill in the criminal justice system. In addition, the impact of mandatory minimum sentencing, including ballot measure 11, with its much longer mandatory sentences for certain offenses, cannot be ignored. It appears to have had an effect on the client's decisions to assert the defense. And certainly the confidence that the judiciary, as well as prosecutors and defense attorneys, have in the board's ability to manage these clients plays a part. The board believes this is a positive thing. Persons who commit crimes as a result of their mental disease or defect do not belong in a correctional facility. The appropriate disposition of these cases ensures that these individuals receive the treatment and services they need to function in society and refrain from being a danger to others. The board's only concern is its ability to manage this ever-increasing number. In light of these facts and figures, it is safe to assume that the number of new persons placed under the board's jurisdiction will continue to rise as it has this biennium. Now, the board has not undergone any major reorganization in the past 10 years. The board continues to operate in general as it has since its creation. Its essential mission and functioning remain virtually the same today as they were at the board's inception in 1978. It is the numbers the board must serve that accounts for the greatest change in operations in this time period. As Ms. Dean noted, a 53% total growth in caseload in the last decade has resulted in tremendous increase in workload. Every new case brings with it more work for each of the four FTE. There is no such thing as economy of scale in our office. Each of the new cases that the board received in 2003 and 2004 required something in addition to, rather than in lieu of, what staff had previously been doing. There is a cumulative effect. The new cases don't just replace old cases anymore. They significantly add to the total tally. Everything the staff does has grown exponentially. We open more cases, track more clients, send more notices, write more case summaries, prepare more exhibits, hold more hearings, issue more orders, review more administrative matters, monitor more clients, revoke more clients, and so on. As this trend of caseload growth began to emerge, the board first initiated some procedural modifications to increase its efficiency and thus handle the additional workload. It adopted new ways to streamline its hearings process so members could hear more cases per day. Further, it began to review more matters administratively rather than holding face-to-face hearings. These actions enabled the board to increase the number of hearings scheduled per day to deal with the reduction in the number of hearing days budgeted. To put that in real numbers, the board has in the last 5 years gone from averaging 13.5 hearings per day to 18. The agency then made some technological changes in order to function more efficiently within the office so that we could try to absorb this increase in workload, which came with the increase in caseload. The board's end goal was to obtain a more comprehensive and stable design as well as to automate document production. Initially, it upgraded its computer system to make its sending notices easier. We computerized the tracking of conditional release clients and reports and updated our network in order to prevent data loss. A file merge was installed so that all the staff used the same system. Previously, the PSRB information was stored in two separate databases. Once located on one customized database, there was less duplication of work as the data did not have to be entered twice. The board and staff have continued to utilize these changes so that the agency operates at maximum efficiency. Also, the board has pursued legislative route for relief from the demands that come with this larger caseload on several different occasions. The board has proposed legislation in a couple of previous sessions to change the time frames of statutorily mandated hearings when the number of hearing days was drastically reduced. This would have cut back the number of hearing days needed. However, that bill did not pass out of committee in either of those two attempts due to advocates' opposition. Most recently, given the tremendous increase in the number of new cases in the past 2 years and the concerns, albeit questionable, that a number of these individuals were inappropriately placed under the board reviewed its enabling statutes to determine what changes might be proffered to assure the hospital and others that the court was only sending appropriate clients to the board's jurisdiction. As a result of this review, the board proposed three legislative concepts that deal with the court process at the front end, and you will see a chart on page 18 of your folder. But I would note that none of these bills have a discernible impact on the board's budget. Oops, 18 is not I'm sorry, not page 18. It is page 23.
We have a ask a question.
Sure.
About the cost on this. My understanding is there's very little. I mean, almost all the money comes from general funds.
Yes, that's correct.
Is there a way that this could change and there could be match, a federal match, if somehow the administration or the work that's being done were tied into the care or the oversight of clients in local facilities that are secured that have less than 16 people in them?
Chair Richardson, the Office of Mental Health gets the Medicaid match for the treatment piece, but I'm not aware of any way that operating the board, the agency piece of this, could get a Medicaid match.
I would assume that this has been looked at, but I'm just wondering whether or not administration can be tied into, you know, the work that's done that is matchable, and whether or not that...
Sure, I don't believe that the service we provide would be Medicaid billable, okay, as opposed to the services that our treatment providers.
Okay, thank you.
However, as long as we're discussing legislation, I did want you to be aware that the Oregon Law Commission, as you'll see on page 24, has submitted Senate Bill 232 for the legislature's consideration, which does establish a juvenile PSRB to assume jurisdiction over young persons who are found responsible except for insanity. The genesis for this bill was the acknowledgement that although juveniles are entitled to assert the insanity defense by case law, the juvenile code provided no dispositional process for courts to utilize after making such a finding. Thus, the work group of the Juvenile Code Revision Subcommittee looked to the PSRB's model as one to emulate and created a parallel system with modifications necessary to address a youth's need and their developmental situation. This bill could have a significant effect on the board's budget, as it would require funding for juvenile board members. What the plan would be is to use the same administrative structure but have a separate panel to hear juvenile cases, so that there would be a juvenile psychiatrist, psychologist, probation officer, a member of the general public, and an attorney that's experienced in juvenile law. And so the funding for that would require board stipends for that panel and their travel expenses, as well as some incidental services and supplies. I think the greatest budget issue now confronting the board, as I think is clear, is the ongoing unprecedented growth in the total number of persons under the jurisdiction, as evidenced by that chart on, that's the chart that's on page 18. As you can see, the board's caseload has grown by more than 250 persons in the past 10 years, but more significantly, 150 of those persons of that growth has been in just the last 5 years, and 66 of the 150 were just in the last 2 years. Some of this is attributable to the fact that in the past, the average number of clients placed under the board each year was equal to the number discharged, either by lapse or by board action. As I said, the board used to average 55 or 60 and discharged an average of 57, so there was no noticeable net gain. But as you can see from the chart in Appendix H, the 99-01 biennium marked a change in that pattern. In 99 and 2000, the board received 151 new cases and discharged only 76. In 2001 and 2, it received 157 and discharged only 121. And I think this goes to your question last time, Representative Hanna, with provided that chart to you that shows the new cases minus the discharged cases to give us that total numeric number. If you flip to Appendix I and review the projected lapses for the next few years, it is indisputable that the total number of PSRB clients will continue to increase. The reason for this is simply that the number of clients whose jurisdiction will lapse by operation of law drops markedly in 2005 and only goes up a bit in 2006, 7, and 8. Thus, there will be a huge net gain to our population. That growth brings with it the associated increase in costs inherent in carrying out the board's responsibilities. That includes the greater number of hearings required for and requested by clients, as well as the attendant services supplies charges for more postage, paper, copying, and the like. But of greater concern to the board is the less quantified, more critical issue of the increase in workload that such growth brings to an overburdened staff. Along with this rise in total population has come a significant increase in the number of clients on conditional release, as I said. And as you can see from the chart, the number has increased from 120 in the past 10 years, of which 31 additional clients were put on conditional release just in between 2003 and 4. Since it became apparent several biennia ago that many PSRB clients were waiting in the hospital at tremendous cost after being found appropriate by the board for conditional release, the board has made concerted efforts to bring their plight to the attention of the Department of Human Services and this legislature. After a couple of one-time infusions of funding for a limited number of new community beds, the 2001 legislature recognized the ongoing need for this type of funding. For the first time, it allotted caseload growth money to DHS for both criminally and civilly committed mentally ill clients, and this enabled the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services to develop some new PSRB placements before that pot of money reverted to the state due to the deficit. This biennium, we have once again engaged in that process, but with a greater commitment of dollars and a much more concerted effort by all stakeholders due to the census crisis in forensics at the state hospital. The board obviously enthusiastically supports the department's efforts thus far to make more community beds available for those whom the board determines can be adequately controlled and treated in the community in a less restrictive and less costly environment. The board has learned that the Office of Mental Health and budget includes caseload growth money, as I said, for 94 additional community placements in the next biennium. Such a plan will have a substantial impact on the workload of the PSRB and staff. The four FTE are already monitoring, as I said, 306 individuals on conditional release, with the idea that maybe 50 or 60 more by June 30th will be, up to close to 360 clients, and I can tell you that staff members are having a difficult time as it is now, and the current staffing level cannot support such growth in the conditional release population if we are to continue to assure public safety. Further, the board members also feel that the effect of the increase in these requests for conditional release, as hearings are required to review any proposed conditional release plan. Then, once a conditional release order is issued, any request for subsequent changes to that plan must be submitted to the board for their review and approval. So the number of matters that must be addressed by the board will continue to rise as well. Given that the board's membership will turn over completely in the next 18 months, it's difficult to contemplate an increase in the number of matters heard per day, which is already pretty high at 18, I would submit. Clearly, the significant growth in both of these areas affects the board's ability to achieve its desired results as outlined in its long-term plan and its performance measures. The other budget issue that I would just mention briefly is the Attorney General charges. As I mentioned once before, I think, at my previous appearance, historically this has been a problem for the board, but in the recent past these costs have leveled out. But the board has no control over the number of appeals that are filed, and so we don't have any control over what the next biennium will bring. Depends upon what issues, you know, some attorneys might bring to have the court review. And unlike the rent or government service charges, which are fixed amounts, or the cost of services, which may not be fixed but has an allotted amount which we have to live within, the cost for Department of Justice representation for appeals is really unpredictable and unknowable. We have had totals in the past of as high as $90,000 in a biennium, and then other years it's been $30,000. The board is hopeful that the amount allotted for Attorney General charges for the next biennium will be sufficient, given the reduction in the number of appeals filed in the past couple of years compared with our historical average. The board has every reason to believe it will be, but I cannot guarantee anything. As I said, these things are beyond the board's control. I would say that to address this uncertainty, in the previous sessions, the budget report from Ways and Means has contained a note directing the board to monitor Attorney General expenditures and invited the agency to return to the e-board with a request for additional resources if costs overran the projected allotment for Attorney General costs. As you can see, the budget, governor's budget includes two policy packages. It is the second policy package which the board believes is critical to its ability to manage its caseload, on which I would like to focus. I guess I would say that hopefully I have already made the need for this position absolutely abundantly clear in my presentation. The bottom line is simply that the agency, as presently staffed, cannot fairly keep pace with the increase in workload that such staggering growth in caseload demands. The board has anticipated the eventual need for this for quite some time. In fact, the board has forewarned lawmakers of this inevitability of this in the past two sessions. Yet the board has not sat idly by as this situation developed over the last few years. In fact, the board has a long history, as I noted, of dating back to 1981, actually, of consistently working with the legislature to continue its effective operation while accommodating these new cases. In the 1980s, we did so by proposing legislation that limits the persons who qualify for the defense and thus come under the board. In addition, the board eliminated at least one of the types of statutorily required hearings that was in the enabling statutes. More recently, the board has aggressively pursued a variety of internal modifications to address this, including the implementation of procedural and technological changes to achieve efficiencies which would assist in handling the increase in caseload, as I detailed earlier. The board again considered a legislative concept to change the timeframes of the hearings, but tabled that idea as that would have an immediate and counterproductive effect on the Oregon State Hospital census, which is already at crisis level. The board has engaged in every effort possible to stave off this eventuality. As you can see, this was not the board's first response to the problem, but rather its last. I'd liken it to the principle in law wherein you have to exhaust all your administrative remedies before looking to the court for relief. The board feels it has exhausted all of its remedies within current resources and now looks to you for relief. I believe the facts and figures to support this proposal are indisputable. The board has not received an increase in staff since 1988, when it went from 3 FTEs to 4. It has remained at that level for 17 years, despite the fact that the board's caseload has grown from approximately 400 to 728, and from 160 on conditional release to 306, with no change in the board's statutory responsibilities to each and every one of these individuals or to the public. Moreover, the board's clientele continues to grow at an astounding rate. There is no indication that this trend will abate anytime soon. Rather, the numbers on those graphs, I think, speak for themselves. Even if one utilizes a conservative estimate of 100 new clients per year for the next biennium and then subtracts the projected discharges for the same time period, there will still be a net gain in the board's population of another 135 by the end of 2005, bringing the board's total to more than 865 clients. Each and every one of those clients, long-standing as well as new, requires a tremendous amount of attention and work by staff throughout the entire course and length of their jurisdiction. Everything the board does in relation to these cases is prescribed by law. The board takes its statutory responsibilities very seriously. It does not wish to violate any of its clients' rights, nor to jeopardize public safety. However, both of these scenarios are becoming more likely as the limitations of current staffing have been reached. Hearings cannot be held in a timely fashion as if the board does not have adequate staffing to do all that is necessary to prepare. More importantly, close monitoring and supervision of clients in the community, which is the hallmark of the board's program and the major reason for its success, cannot be assured for the growing number who achieve conditional release, as there is only so much 4FTE can do. I have frankly struggled to figure out how I could articulate to you or quantify the work that my staff does. Because the staff, as I mentioned I think last time, because my staff are exempt, I can't provide you with verified overtime accounts. However, I will tell you that these individuals are regularly putting in 50 to 55 hours per week without additional compensation. I, as well as the state, am most fortunate to have the dedicated and conscientious staff that I have. Their work ethic is exemplary. And frankly, that's the only reason this board has survived as it has thus far. The agency has maxed out its options for increased efficiency through technology. The need now requires another human being, a body, a person with intellect and judgment necessary to perform these tasks. A computer cannot read these files and determine what should be an exhibit. A computer can't read every document and, you know, cull the information for a case summary. A computer can't talk to a case manager and make the professional judgment as to whether an individual should be returned to the hospital because of some behavior. The policy option package in the governor's recommended budget provides for that person. If it is not approved, the ability to sustain this pace will be lost and the board will be unable to keep up with the demands of this important statutory responsibility. Performance measures will surely plummet. However, if that alone is not persuasive, the board would point to the effect the board's operations have on the rest of the forensic system as a whole. The board does not function in a vacuum. What it can or cannot do greatly impacts the other parts of the system. The other players, including the Oregon State Hospital, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and community mental health agencies, are dependent on the board and cannot complete their roles until the board takes some action.
Question?
Yeah.
What would be the designation of the new employee that you're requesting?
The designation?
Administrative specialist?
Administrative assistant, yes, Chair Richardson.
I noticed that out of the four employees that you currently have, that is, you have one administrative specialist. All the others have management designations. And so you've got a total staff of four people and three have management. And there are consequences financially to that. Could you help me understand why you have three in management designations?
Chair Richardson, my information on that was that when the board was first created, I mean, that goes back to the actual inception of the board in 1978, and that the obviously the director is management, there was an executive secretary, and the administrative assistant, the first three FTEs were all management. When the
can you tell me why would an executive assistant or executive secretary the management? I mean, I'm trying to understand why we would have those designations. Maybe,
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jan Dean with Budget and Management Division. I believe that in this case what you have is a management service designation, which frankly then excludes these people from having overtime payments. They are actually administrative support positions, not managers in the sense of managing people, but the designation within the personnel system denotes them as management service.
What about the comment that that there's no overtime for the staff because they're unrepresented? If the administrative specialist is not having that designation, then is overtime paid to that person?
Chair Richardson, no.
So going back to your how does your definition square with the reality that you have people that are not management that are not collecting overtime?
Chair Richardson, I would not want to intimate that I am a personnel specialist. That said, within the state system, management service is a designation similar to unrepresented, represented, etc., that you can still have administrative specialist positions within all of those categories, and so they are management service. I don't know the reasons why, quite honestly, but it does mean that they still would perform the same kinds of duties that an administrative specialist that is represented would do, but for whatever reason, probably I'm guessing because of potentially confidentiality issues or something, when this board was set up, the system designated them as management service.
Okay, I guess I need some. I need a tutorial on what the consequences are of these designations, because my understanding is that it does cost the taxpayers more, and that, I mean, you're doing the same work, but if a different designation means there's different, you know, pay differentials, and certainly people need to be paid for the work that they do, but not through artificially determined designations. So I just want to make sure that the people are being well represented in that area. So if you could help arrange for me to get a breakdown showing how that all works. Thank you.
Briefly, if the board does not have adequate resources to respond to the request of the other stakeholders and needs in a timely fashion, the system cannot and will not function. This is a critical factor to consider in light of DHS's and the hospital's plan to significantly change the focus and size of Oregon State Hospital in the next biennium. The plan involves, as you may have heard, downsizing the hospital by moving patients to the community-based facilities. This certainly is a worthy goal. However, because of the Oregon's award-winning statutory scheme for the disposition of these clients, the board alone has jurisdiction over these individuals and must be involved in and participate and ultimately take the legal action for each one of these individuals.
So what you're saying is that every patient that is moved out of the state hospital into a community-based facility will be an additional patient for the board to deal with, or client, or...
Chair Richards, we will continue. Actually, the responsibility becomes greater on the board once they're moved into the community, because, you know, while they're in the hospital, we know where they are, we receive the reports, you know, continue that. But once they go to the, you know, into the community, then it's the board's sole statutory responsibility to monitor them. The hospital doesn't have that role anymore. It's the board's responsibility in collaboration with our community providers. So we have case managers who report to the board, but we ultimately have to, you know, make the decision whether they, you know, keep track of them, make sure they are complying with their conditions of release, and if not, make the decision as to whether they need to be returned to the hospital. So clearly the more important function, I think, you know, at least from the public safety perspective, is that of the monitoring function once they are released from the hospital.
Thank you.
Such an effort to required to achieve this goal will be immense. As I said, due to the nature of that process, much of the work will fall to the board and its staff, as they are involved in each step of the process. For, as I mentioned, it is not just getting the clients out, but also and more importantly, successfully keeping them out, which will ultimately impact the hospital census and the public safety. That is reflected in the board's performance measures, both number one and number four. It is obviously critical to public safety that the board have the resources necessary to monitor all those in the community as well as it has to this point. Clearly, the board's success is based in large part upon the staff's ability to effectively monitor these individuals and to work with their case managers. Without additional staff to assist with this responsibility, I fear the board's mission of protecting the public could be jeopardized. On the other hand, the board would be able to adjust those targets for these two measures if this package were approved, as the additional staff person could be utilized in part to more intensely and proactively monitor those on conditional release and troubleshoot issues at the onset. So we would actually, you know, as we talked about in our previous session when we did our targets for both performance measure one and four, for the next biennium, those numbers were higher, and I think if we had the staff, you know, to help more closely monitor that, we would be able to adjust those targets to lower numbers, to back to maybe 2%, which is what our, you know, current just over the long period of time that figure is. So we would be more than happy, and I think that we could also continue to maintain the higher number. Right now we're averaging about almost 98% maintaining people in the community. That target had gone down in anticipation of more people being in the community, but I think with additional staff and watching them closely, we could keep that number up by 97 or 98% as well. So based on those reasons, the board would urge this committee to approve the governor's budget as proposed, and I thank you for your time and attention and be happy to answer any further questions you might have.
Are there questions?
I think that was incredibly thorough. We shouldn't. To paraphrase, you need another staff person.
Yeah, did you get that?
Mr. Chair, I had the honor of touring the psychiatric hospital yesterday, and it was very interesting to see the various floors, and even you can even feel the difference in the intensity going from, I guess you'd call them, ward to ward. But I was interested in the geriatric unit. Are they more readily... are there certain, I don't know what to call them, wards that are more ready to go out into the community than others? And I was thinking, is the geriatric population, they're probably, when you think geriatric, you think maybe more docile, but maybe that's not the case.
Chair Richardson, Senator Mona Sanderson, I think that in that hospital there are wards that are, you know, that are designed. I mean, if you went to the 48 building, that's the maximum security where they start, or where more problematic clients might be held, at least in the forensic system. Geriatric ward, more of those individuals are civilly committed than under the board, but we do have a number on those wards. And, yes, what happens usually with those clients is that they looked for, you know, more SPD homes, you know, given their age, and we're looking for more nursing care facility rather than some of the other types of facilities we are developing. But some of the other wards, I don't know if you got to see the 50 building versus the 41, but 50 is sort of the medium security, and then a 41 wards are the transition wards. When you're on the 41 ward, then, you know, you've already been approved for conditional release planning, and some of those, they receive the privileges that are necessary to start proving themselves and things like that. So the hospital is designed to have different, you know, wards and levels attended with their readiness for conditional release. And that's, you know, what the board looks for, and frankly what the community looks for, because, as you know, when the hospital says they're ready, then we do the separate, you know, evaluate order to the community provider to ask them to do an independent assessment whether they agree that this person is ready. And so they look to see, you know, what progress they've made in making their way through the different wards at the hospital.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Just final thought, as I went through your financials, I noticed that you have looked at areas where you might conserve, and that you've reduced your requests for funds for training, which to me means that you're planning on doing training out of existing funds that you have, and so we commend you in looking for areas where you might economize. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have, for public testimony, Michael Morris. Come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Mental Health Policy Manager for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services with the Department of Human Services. And I am here to support the request for additional staff person that you've already have heard all of the multiple reasons why that they are in need of the staff person. We recognize the work that they are currently doing, and with our development and working on developing placements in the community, we and trying to move 50 to 60 individuals before the end of this biennium, we see the stress that we are putting on the staff that are currently there to do all the work, background work, to get all the hearings in place and make the conditional releases happen as the new development comes on board. So I'm just here to reinforce and offer our support for this request. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
No, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming. Is there any other public testimony? I think that seeing none, we can go ahead and close this public session and adjourn. Seeing no objection, adjourn.
Mr. Chair, is it true that we aren't going to have